It's time for the 841 stretch, I guess. It's This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis, and this is a good trivia question. I don't know whether you want to say who was Ray Nelson or
right.
Phrase it in another way.
The first organist at Wrigley Field, but also the very first major league team the Cubs were to use organ music in the ballpark, Bob. And Ray Nelson was it, entertaining the fans before the game, taking a seat at the organ there behind the grandstands. But it did not last, Bob, because the Chicago Tribune notes, I went back and looked at these stories, Nelson was required to cut off the music before the game began because the Cubs didn't have the rights to the music. So they're like, you can't play. Sorry, if it makes it over the radio broadcast, if it's on the loudspeaker, then you're going to be in violation. So, you know, that's how they had to work around it. So eventually, of course, they got the rights and that sort of thing. But his first stint, Ray Nelson, and the reason why it's a great trivia question, Bob, is because it only lasted 2 days.
That's unbelievable. I wonder how they got around the rights issues.
Yeah,
they figured something out.
They figured it out. They paid the record label something, but and then it wasn't until, what is it, 1967, 25 years later, when they got the full-time organist and they started it up. Gary Pressey, by the way, took a seat at the organ in 1987. He is the longest running organist in the history of baseball. And it was for 33 years he was sitting there at the keyboard. And so if you went to a game any point between 1987 and 2019 when he retired, Gary Pressey was the organist for you. Here's a little bit from him right around the time of his retirement.
When we have a night game, which starts at 7 o'clock, set up the music, and I start playing as soon as the gates open up, and we take up organ music all the way to like around 6:30, and then we have announcements that have to be made and videos now. And then during the games, I'm here to get the crowd going, to get the team going, and then, of course, the stretch. And that is always an exciting part of my job.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure at this point you can play it in your sleep. Maybe you do. Maybe you
heard a lot. A lot of people sing it.
Unlike Nancy Faust on the South Side, Gary Pressey had to accompany some very strange singers, didn't he?
Mike Dick is up there. He said he was his favorite, but he's also the most memorable because he arrived late to the press box and then just barreled through the whole song really quickly, and he had to keep up with them. Very memorable rendition of the seventh inning stretch.
To say the least. Don Cornelius, part of Chicago broadcast history, and the whole deal started here, didn't it?
You know, it's so interesting. His life story and just his vision, I think, comes to life when you think about who he was and what he did. He created the idea for the show called Soul Train. He was a former DJ at VON, WVON. Don Cornelius moved to TV. He was at CIU. He was a news reporter. He was an opinion show guy. Fun fact, before that, he was a used car salesman and briefly a Chicago police officer. Kind of interesting. But as TV host and a producer, you know, he found his calling. He just had these great instincts. And I remember the Soul Train dance line. You know, who can forget that? He said he just saw it kind of happen, you know, organically on set one day. And he said, that's something. We're going to do that. And then the very next year, 1971, after he debuted it on the local affiliate, it went into national syndication. Gladys Knight on the very first show, from the music to the artist to the dance line. It was all such a huge hit from the very beginning.
That brings us to the end of what we hope has been a beautiful trip for you and what certainly has been a groovy ride for me. We thank you for joining us. We thank our very exciting guests, Gladys Knight and the Pips, the Honeycone, Bobby Hutton, special guest Eddie Kendricks, and of course the Soul Train Gang. Hope you'll climb aboard next week on these same stations, and you can bet your last money it's all going to be a stone gas, honey. Always in parting, we're going to wish you love, peace, and soul.
Love it.
Love it.
Started in Chicago in 1970. You know, there's, I guess it's an urban legend. Uh-huh. I've never been able to get to the bottom of this, that when he was a police officer, he stopped somebody who worked at WVON radio, and the person said, wow, your voice is tremendous. Did you ever think of a career in broadcasting? And that's how it started. I don't know if that's urban legend or fact.
I don't know.
I'm still working on that.
Yeah, what a great story if it's true. But he found his way, for sure.
I met him one time in Los Angeles, larger than life, I can tell you that.
You can hear the DJ in him, too, that he brought to television, all those sayings, those quick, quick talk.
The best. The coolest. Yes. And broadcasting history from Chicago for Paul Harvey this week in 1944.
Hello, Americans. This is Paul Harvey.
Stand by for Anna DeVlantis.
Paul Harvey, yeah, that's right, Bob, began his broadcasting career this very week in 1944. We know the rest of the story. Paul Harvey became a legend, national host, $100 million contract, legions of loyal fans. But it started when Paul Harvey left the Army during World War II, decided to relocate to Chicago from his native Tulsa, and he worked there as a news reporter. He came here to work at WENR, the ABC affiliate in town, later LS. But, you know, he hosted at first a news program, a commentary program, and then he used that famous phrase, what would become a famous phrase, now you know the rest of the story, at the end of his in-depth reporting, and it just kind of stuck. You know, he worked with his wife, Lynn, as you know, Bob, an accomplished producer in her own right, came up with the idea for a regular feature. The rest of the story grew into a six-day-a-week feature in 1976, reaching as many as 24 million people every single week. Here is Paul Harvey.
Now, the rest of the story. Once upon a time, many centuries ago, in the Aegean island of Samos, there was a certain slave, and we are told that he was born in Phrygia about 620 BC. He was brought to Athens as a boy, and there, the story goes, he was sold to a man named Labmon, who took him thence to his island home. But what that means is that the final and most remarkable of what we now call Aesop's fables was Aesop himself. He was himself a fable. Now that you know the rest of the story.
I still miss him, I'll tell you.
What a storyteller. I mean, just the way he captivated so many people and you felt he was your friend. That's, in fact, what his son, Paul Harvey Jr., said the day he died in 2009. Millions of people have lost a friend today, and I think that certainly rung true. But Paul Harvey continued to work almost to the day of his death and just left an incredible mark.
Let me tell you what I learned from him. Coming up. Pizza history and more. See how
the power of the pause.
Yeah. Then you perk up. You want to listen. It's 8:48.
Stand by for news.
And weather and traffic. Mahalia Jackson, part of This Week in Chicago History. And I didn't know she started here in Chicago.
Came here as a teenager, Bob. She escaped. I think she was in New Orleans, and it was escaping poverty and just coming here for opportunity. She wanted to sing, and she did. Became the first gospel artist to do so many things. That song right there, Move On Up a Little Higher, that song sold 2 million copies, claimed the number two spot on the Billboard charts, both of those firsts in the gospel music industry. She just broke through all barriers, really, performed on some of the biggest stages and for several presidents, sang the national anthem at President Kennedy's inaugural ball, and just, you know, really made her mark on the industry. When she started to gain traction, though, Bob, a lot of advisors in the music industry said, don't do gospel. Go more mainstream now because you're going to sell more records. But she didn't. She clung to her roots, and she just really like I say, made her mark. Religious woman, really wanted to do gospel, and also known to be incredibly kind and a generous woman who would welcome people into her home and cook for them when they were down on their luck. Here's Mahalia Jackson.
I remember way back in the 1930s, Miss Lee, when the Depression was in 29, when I was hardly making a dollar, 50 cents or 75, I stopped there on the Highway 41 and get neck boned and ham hocks and smoked rib and string beans and beans. And I'm a good cook, and I'd cook big pans of cornbread. I've seen men that have lost their pride. And I brought them to my house. Didn't know where I was going to get the next nickel from. But you can't be God-given. And I mean, I would feed those people. Make big old bowls of potato salad. And today, that's my joy. When people come to my house, I don't go to theaters and I don't go to nightclubs. But I do like to have people to come to my house And I fixed him something to eat.
Nobody went home hungry. No. I'll tell you that. Mahalia Jackson recorded that Move On Up a Little Higher song back in 1947, this week in 1947. Now let's talk about this guy's one of the founding fathers of Chicago pizza, isn't he?
It's such a competitive world, and to think that a small guy, like a mom-and-pop style thing, has really still makes the lists of the most delicious pizzas in Chicago. Pequod's Pizza. Have you ever had Pequod's Pizza?
Bob? I've had it. People love the crust, don't they?
He invented, they say, or at least is credited with inventing, the caramelized crusts, which apparently he makes by sprinkling, he invented by sprinkling cheese around the edges of the pan, and so it kind of browns against the crust, and it just tastes pretty darn delicious, I'd say. But Burt Katz is the guy, restaurateur slash commodities trader, who decided he was sick of commodities trading, and he started a restaurant. And yes, it's named after the whaling ship in Moby Dick. Yes, that is thong underwear the whale is wearing on its head. He had a sense of humor, kind of an unusual guy. I think you've met him, right?
I had a hot dog with him once at Poochie's.
And
let me tell you, this guy, he was different, let's just say. Sometimes he wouldn't even answer the phone at his restaurant because he just thought, oh, that's enough already. Yeah. I don't need more customers.
I got enough going on here. Just unusual guy, but really had a vision for pizza. Gulliver's Pizza was his first. Some listeners will remember this. It was there for 50 years on Howard Street in Rogers Park. He took the cast iron pizza pans from there, Bob, from Gulliver's, brought him over to Pequod's when he started it. And it was pan pizza, remember, not deep dish. His was pan pizza with that caramelized crust that so many people came back for. Also a radio buff, kind of interesting, because you saw all the vintage radios at his original Morton Grove restaurant and the microphones, pictures of microphones on the wall. And then people would slap their ham radio call letters up onto the ceiling beams. So it was a very decorative place. Had a nice, a Roosevelt High School grad, too.
Yeah, that's right.
Just like you.
Maybe that explains why he was a little different.
Something in the water there.
Opened up Pequod's this week in 1971. Yeah, he was something else. All right, that's it. This Week in Chicago History. More next Wednesday. Thanks, Anna.
Talk to you then. Thanks, Bob.
9 o'clock news coming up next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.